The question was asked, what is the difference between Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Brura, Shulchan Aruch Harav, and Likutei Halachot? So, in order to understand what the difference is, we have to understand what they are, and then we will understand, hopefully, what the difference is. Okay, let's get there, okay? Okay, so we begin with a few hundred years before creation, where Hashem had the Torah, conceptually Hashem had a Torah, black fire, white fire, whatever that means. There was the concept of Torah before it was given. And then we have creation, right? Adam's created on Friday. And it says, Yom HaShishi, all of creation is waiting for that sixth day of the month of Sivan, the holiday of Shavuot, when Hashem will give His Jewish people the Torah. And so we have Adam, 10 generations later we have the flood and Noah, 10 generations later we have Avram Avinu, in the year 1948 from creation, Abraham is born. In the year 2000, Abraham recognizes his creator when he is 52 years old. Abraham will have a son Yitzchak when he is 100 years old. He will have a son Yaakov. Yaakov will have the 12 tribes. We will descend to Egypt, come out of Egypt in the year 2448, and receive the Torah at Sinai. When we receive the Torah at Sinai that year, so Moshe ascends the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and Hashem gives him the written Torah and the oral Torah. He gives him, the Talmud and Tractate Brachos tells us, Torah Nevi'im Ketuvim Mishnah Gemara. So from Moshe Rabbeinu onward, we have the written Torah, most of the five books of Moshe, right? The books were only completed at the end of the 40 years, but at least until Parashat Mishpatim was given to him in writing at that point. And we have all the concepts that would later be elaborated on in the prophets and writings. They were all also given to Moshe. And then we have an oral Torah. That oral Torah is divided into segments. Rambam discusses that in his introduction to Mishnah. So the oral Torah, we have parts of the oral Torah that define the written Torah. So the Torah says, where tutafot? What are tutafot? Tutafot is an ornament, is a jewel you put on here. Ah, but we say, no, it's tefillin. And they have to be black, and the straps have to be black. So part of that is biblical. Part of that is halachal Moshe Mishinai. It's a tradition from Moshe from Sinai. But it's not. It doesn't have a source in the text. And part of that is rabbinic interpretation of the text. Part of how we set up tefillin. So that's also biblical. But it's the rabbinic interpretation of the biblical, which is also biblical. That's called divrei sofrim, the words of the scribes, the words of the rabbis. So the rabbis will sometimes define a pasuk for us, and that definition is biblical. Then you have rabbinic institutions. Ah, but there's one more thing we skipped. There's another thing. There are the laws of derivation. There's the concept that the Hashem gave Moshe Rabbeinu 13 logical laws of derivation, and we're supposed to apply them to the Torah in order to derive the answer to many questions. So far, so good. Yeah. What are the 13 laws of derivation? Klal uprat, klal uprat uklal. We say it every morning. Kal vachomer, right. If you want to see them in their original form, they are the source for the 13 laws of derivation. It is written in the beginning of the Safra de Bei Rav, the Medrash Halacha an Vayikra, also known as Torat Kohanim. Yeah. Rabbi Ishmael was enumerating them. The tradition goes back to Moshe. Yes. Midot, drasha. Drasha, when to derive is, you say one thing, and I can understand more from it. So let's say, if we would say that the Torah says a person is not allowed to marry their granddaughter. So I can understand from that that they're also not allowed to marry their daughter, right? So that I derived that. It doesn't say that. The Torah doesn't say anywhere you can't marry your own daughter. It It says you can't marry your granddaughter. It says you can't marry your stepdaughter. It says girls that are further from you are prohibited. You understand that even your own daughter is prohibited. Yes? Okay. So that's derivation. It doesn't say it, but through logic, you can derive it. So we have 13 laws, which are logical laws. So far, we're all together?
Yes.
Okay. When Moshe goes up to Sinai, so Hashem teaches him all of this, but there's another aspect. One of the key points in halacha is a concept called medame milita le milita, to compare. What is this similar to? So he asked me a question earlier tonight. Can I light Hanukkah candles on Skype? Do I compare that to the shul in Alexandria? Do I compare that to a person who will just put up a picture of his candles? What do I compare it to? So part of understanding halacha is also understanding, is this case comparable to A or to B? What's it similar to, right? So far we're all together? Yes? We said there are laws of derivation. We also said sometimes you have to know what to compare it to. So let's take an example. What would be a good example? I live in Manhattan, and in Manhattan you're not allowed to carry things on Shabbat, right? We know that you're not supposed to carry in public domain on Shabbat. So far we're all together? Yes? Okay, so let's say a person lives in Manhattan, and I beg your forgiveness, but there has been a little bit of activity near our home. I don't know if you guys, in the last hour or two. So I have to be a little bit on top of what goes on because my wife doesn't always get the SMSs and I do. Meaning the yeshuv sent out a warning that in Adam, which is the yeshuv next door to us, there was terrorist activity. That's why I have my cell phone here. Also, I don't know when the pizza guy shows up, but that's why I'm also looking at SMSs. So at any rate, back to a person lives in Manhattan, so he knows he's not allowed to carry something in his hand when he walks around, right? You're not allowed to carry something in your hand on Shabbat in public domain. So far, so good? Okay. I know that if I have a filling in my mouth, I'm allowed to walk around with a filling in my mouth, right? I'm allowed to walk around wearing my watch. I'm allowed to. What about wearing a toupee, a wig? Am I allowed to walk around public domain with a wig? Imagine I would put on a wig. Am I allowed to walk with a wig? Next question. I'm chewing gum. Am I allowed to walk around in public domain with gum in my mouth? So, do I compare gum in my mouth to a filling in my mouth? Do I compare gum in my mouth to carrying something in my hand? You understand that in halakha, very often the exact case is not written in halakha. I have to know what to compare it to. Okay? So that's an element of halakha. Questions that come up. Today, scientifically, we can do many things. I want to light a Hanukkah candle, an electric Hanukkah candle. Is that permissible? Today in Europe, they have types of cans which are divided. There's the upper part of the can where you have coffee or soup. And on the bottom part of the can is a mechanism that really houses two chemicals. And you turn the bottom of the can, there's a handle, and when you turn the bottom of the can, so it breaks the barrier in between the two chemicals, the two chemicals mix, and they heat up they form a chemical reaction that causes tremendous heat, and it heats up the top, and within a minute you have a hot cup of coffee in your hand, okay? Am I allowed to do that on Shabbat? Is that called cooking on Shabbat? What do I compare it to? So a lot of our dealings with halacha day to day is a question of, do I compare it to A? Do I compare it to B? A lot of halacha is not written clearly in Shulchan Aruch or in the Talmud. We have many halachot that are discussed. I have a friend who married a girl. They came over for a Shabbos meal. And the girl in conversation says, you know, I'm a test tube baby. I said, what? She said, I was born out of in vitro fertilization. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, according to this rabbi, she's this. According to that rabbi, she's that. You know, is a test tube baby a Jew? You know, the baby, they took seed from her father, they took an egg from her mother, they put it together in a petri dish, and later on they stuck it back into the mother, and then it developed into a baby. So is that considered born from a Jew? Right? Or if her father's a Kohen, is she a Kohen? If her father's a Levi, is she a Levi? Rav Shlomo Zalman held yes, Rav Moshe Feinstein held no. Okay? Rav Moshe Feinstein held that a baby born from in vitro fertilization is not a Kohen. Rav Shlomo Zalman held he is a Kohen. So Rav Herschel Schachter once gave a class here in Israel where he spoke about how a test tube baby is not a Kohen. And after the class, there was a man standing there wagging his finger, very upset. Rav Shlomo Zalman told me I am a Kohen because he was his father was a Kohen and he was born from in vitro fertilization. Okay, so I'm saying a lot of halacha is this question. Which do I compare it to? It's called midame, milita le milita, to compare one thing to another. The more we understand the depths of the halacha, the more we can understand what to compare it to. So far, we're all together? So what we've discussed so far is, let's just recap. We said before creation, there was Torah. Then we have creation in Adam, 10 generations to Noah, 10 generations to Abraham. Avram is born in the year 1948 from creation. In the year 2448, we receive the Torah. When we leave Egypt, in the year 2448, when we receive the Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Talmud says in Tractate Brachos, page 5a, that Moshe received the written Torah, all the concepts that would be in the prophets and writings, and an oral Torah. Together with that, we said Moshe received 13 laws of derivation, and a concept of halacha l'Moshe mi-Sinai, laws that would be on tradition, but they don't really have a source, and the responsibility of the rabbis to understand and interpret the Torah, we call that Tifrei Sofrim. And finally, there's another concept called Midameh Milta Lemilta. You have to compare in halacha, you have to understand the halacha well to know what to compare it to. So far, we're all together? Okay. Next, when Moshe is up at Sinai, so Hashem tells him, okay, here's this law, here's that law, here's the next law. Here are the laws of derivation. Now start applying them. And Moshe Rabbeinu applies them. And as he's applying them, he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, I see that using these laws, I can sometimes use the laws and come out with a conclusion about a question that it's permitted. And I could prove it from here and from here and from here and from here and from here. And I could come up with a conclusion that it's prohibited. And I could also prove it from numerous places. How do I know which way is right? Right? That was Moshe's question. So Hashem said to Moshe, when you come down from the mountain, you will convene a court. You will teach that court. You will teach them all these laws of derivation. And then the court will learn the Torah, and they will apply the laws of derivation, you together with them. Now, when you apply the laws of derivation, so every person, in order to learn these laws, has to be a good person, a kind person, an honest person. And a person has to be very careful not to allow their personal feelings to get involved. When we study Torah, we're trying to understand what is Hashem telling me. I was giving class this past Shabbos, and I said a pshat in the Mishnah. And someone raised their hand in shul and said, you know, I think... And he argued for a minute. And I said, you know, I agree with you. I think just like you. But that I don't think that's what the Mishnah is saying. I agree with you. I would have said the same thing as you. If I were writing the Mishnah, I would say what you just said. But I don't think that's what the Mishnah is telling us. The commentaries don't interpret the Mishnah that way. And we're trying to understand what the Mishnah is saying. Philosophically, I agree with you. I'm saying when we study Torah, what we're really trying to do is see, what is Hashem telling us? What is the tradition telling us? That involves a very big effort in being honest, being impartial. It's not my feelings, it's what is the Torah telling me. So whoever makes it to the court has to have learned a lot and worked very hard at getting a deep understanding of the laws of derivation right. After you have that, so you have 71 sages doing that, you will have a halachic question that arises. You will come to a vote. And then each rabbi will argue with the other rabbi. They'll explain what they're saying. And when we're done, Hashem tells Moshe, there's the human factor. That means that what seems most logical to me, even after you and I have argued for an hour, I still will think that this is more logical, and you'll think that's more logical. That's the human factor. And then you come to a vote, and you go by the majority opinion. So far we're all together? Wait. Okay, so are you with me? Okay, so now Moshe comes down, and we start having the oral law, and the oral law develops. Because the courts are developing. There are new questions arise. They apply the laws of derivation. Let's skip forward, okay? We're going to move forward to the first temple, which is approximately, when was the first temple built, guys? How many years after we left Egypt? What does it say? No, kings, I think. No, yeah, kings, in the beginning of kings. What does it say? How many years since we left Egypt? What does it say? It says 480 years since we left Egypt. Okay, 400. So if we left Egypt in 2448, add 480. New guys, mathematicians. 2928, right? In the year 2928, King Solomon builds the first temple. Yes, 2928. Approximately a little bit over 400 years later, No, 500 years later. Vinoshantim. No, 400. Vinoshantim. A little over 400 years later, so it's in the middle of the fourth millennium, approximately the year 3500, first temple's destroyed. We come back and build the second temple approximately the year 3600, and that temple is destroyed approximately the year 4000. So far, we're okay? Yeah. We're now in the year 5778, yeah? So that might be our pizza, I'm sorry. So we have the tradition, we have the high court, which rules on any question that comes up, and then we have the destruction of the... We have the destruction of the second temple. So far, so good? Yes? You with me? Okay. Now, what happens is, in the last 100 years before the destruction of the second temple, we have two great sages. One is named Hillel, and the other one is named Shammai. And Hillel is the prince. He is the Nasi. We have a king from the Hasmonean Empire, but that's irrelevant. As far as our Torah world, we have Hillel as the Nasi, we have Shammai as the head of the court, and between Hillel and Shammai, we don't have enough for two for each person, so I'm not sure what we're going to do yet. We're going to wait and see what to do about that. So we have Hillel and Shammai, 100 years before the destruction of the Second Temple, they have Machloket. Until the period of Hillel and Shammai, every argument was ruled on. You had a bottom line. In the period of Hillel and Shammai, you have three standing arguments. It's the first time in Jewish history that three arguments hold out. And there's no... at that point, there isn't a ruling. Then their disciples start having many machlokot. Their disciples are called Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And their machlakot, why do they argue? So, the Roman persecution forbade learning and teaching Torah. They couldn't learn the way people had learned until then. They had to learn in hiding. You couldn't learn openly. To master the tradition, you need to really spend a lot of time studying. And they just weren't on the level. Rav Shri Aigon says it was because of the persecution. Rambam says they didn't have the spiritual level. Now, they were huge. They were giants. When we say they weren't on the level, we mean they weren't on the level of Hillel and Shammai. But who were their students? Rav Yonatan ben Uziel, it says that when he would learn Torah, any bird that would fly next to him would get burnt. He was so holy. Who were their students? Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, the master of the oral tradition. When we say they weren't on the level, we mean they were giants, much bigger than we can imagine. Their student was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who wrote the Zohar. Okay? So they were bigger than him. And we say they weren't on the level. They weren't on the level of Hillel and Shammai in the earlier generations, but they were still giants. And then we enter the period called the Tanaic era. So really the Tanaic era technically began in the Second Temple. But we don't know too much about it until we reach the end of the Second Temple period. That's where we start seeing the names of the rabbis. Because until Hillel and Shammai, everyone in the Tanaic era agreed. When there was a disagreement, they came to a conclusion. So only from Hillel and Shammai onward do we start seeing the names of rabbis appear, because that's where a rabbi started arguing, and this was his opinion, this was his opinion. Until that generation, everyone came to an agreement. Are we together so far? So that's our Mishnah. So even though Mishnah existed from the days of Moshe, but the Mishnah that we have is primarily the opinions, it's where the opinions diverge, and that is after Hillel and Shammai, primarily post-Second Temple. After the destruction of the Second Temple, most of the opinions in Shas Mishnayot are arguments in that period. Along comes Rebbe. Rebbe has a wonderful relationship with Antoninus, the Roman governor, and Antoninus backs Rebbe, and now Rebbe can open up yeshivas again, and people unite and learn Torah, and Rebbe says we have to write down a version of the Mishnah so people don't forget it. Rebbe realizes that things are going to take a long time before the Jews reconquer Israel and reestablish their own sovereignty. And so Rebbe takes advantage of his era and writes down the Mishnah. Now, Mishnah is just a short version of the oral law. The logic behind the Mishnah is still the Talmud, and that they didn't dare write down. Everyone gave it over by oral tradition. Only a few centuries later do the rabbis realize they're going to forget the Talmud, and then they convene the great yeshivas in Babylon, and they write down a version of Talmud, what we call the Babylonian Talmud. Now, within that Talmud, we have codes. We have codes of how you're supposed to rule when there are arguments. And those codes are complex. So, for example, the Talmud says, you should light your Hanukkah candles low. Because the Talmud says, if you had the option of lighting your Hanukkah candles high up, then how come the halacha says that if you're traveling with your camel, and your camel has flax on it, and the flax gets on fire, so then if the person left his flame outside his store, he has to pay. Why did you leave your fire outside your store? Right? The Mishnah says, if I leave a candle lighting outside my store and it lights someone else's cotton as they're walking in the street, I have to pay. Unless it's my Hanukkah candles, then I don't have to pay because I was allowed to leave it there. So the Talmud says, you see from that, if I were allowed to light my Hanukkah candles very high, then the guy should say, even though you have to light Hanukkah candles, light them higher up. What'd you do light them so low? From the fact that the halacha says you don't have to pay, that shows that you have to light them low. So far, so good. Then the Talmud says, maybe it's not such a good proof, because maybe you're allowed to light them high up, but the rabbis didn't make you do it. They said you have a right to light them lower as far as the public zoning laws. You're allowed to light them lower because they wanted to make it easy for people to keep the mitzvah. The Talmud doesn't answer what the bottom line is. Now, I'm asking you, based on that discussion, do you have to light Hanukkah candles low or not? The Talmud began by saying yes, and then the Talmud said maybe not. So which way is it, bottom line? So that's an argument. Rambam, Reif, Rashi, Tosfos. When the Talmud said maybe not, do we rule like the maybe not? Or because the Talmud just said maybe not, that maybe doesn't push off the first opinion, which says yes. Which one wins? So that's two opinions in halacha. Okay, that's an argument between Maimonides and the Tosfos. When the Talmud says maybe, do we go with that answer? An answer that the Talmud gave is a maybe. Yes? So now on halacha came the Shulchan Aruch. we zoom forward to the end of the 14th, 15th century. The end of the 15th century. In the 15th century, we have Rabbi Yosef Karo. And until the period of Rabbi Yosef Karo, the rabbis learned Talmud so well that every rabbi, like Maimonides, like the Rosh, would come and give halachic ruling straight from the Talmud or the Talmud in commentaries. They would learn Rashi, they would learn Maimonides, Rif, Rosh, and they would give halachic ruling. What Rabbi Yosef Karo saw was that in his generation, the rabbis had a very hard time to master all of the Talmud and the commentaries. And he said, I'm going to write a bottom line version of what the ruling is. And so Rabbi Yosef Karo put together the opinions of Rambam, Rif, Rashi, Rosh. He put together those opinions and gave us what we know as the Shulchan Aruch, the Codex, which gives us halachic ruling in all of these questions. Until Rabbi Yosef Karo came along, every rabbi would sit and work it out himself. And Rabbi Yosef Karo said, if I leave it that way, most of Israel won't have rabbis. Most people wouldn't be able to do it. I'll tell you a secret. The Ramah, the Ashkenazi equivalent of Rabbi Yosef Karo, writes that when he became rabbi, every time he'd give halachic ruling, someone in the congregation would say, but Rabbi! And they'd come and pull out a book which he wasn't aware of, and they'd question his ruling. And he'd say, gee, I didn't know that. And he'd have to go over that other book. And the Ramah says, even though I learned, I was rabbi of the community, and I knew enough to give halachic ruling, but people would quote from sources that I didn't have readily available, and they'd undo whatever ruling I gave. And so the Ramah sat down and put together his own codex, just like the Shulchan Aruch did. He wrote his own Shulchan Aruch. He called it, they call it the Mapa. If the Shulchan Aruch is the table, Shulchan Aruch means the set table, so Mapa means the tablecloth. So that's why the Ramah is called the Mapah, so it's a tablecloth over the Shulchan Aruch. So the Shulchan Aruch is the rulings of Rav Yosef Karo, where Rav Yosef Karo tried to give us a bottom line between Maimonides and Rabbi Yitzchak of Fez, the Rif, and the Rosh, Rabbi Asher, who was originally rabbi in Germany, in Rutenberg, under his Rebbe, the Maharam, and then later on in Spain. He took over the community in Barcelona. He took over the community after Nachmanides. He had to emigrate to Spain. So we have three major opinions, and Shulchan Aruch gives us ruling. Usually he goes with the best of three, the majority opinion. So when we speak about Shulchan Aruch, that is the first work that said, let me give you a bottom line ruling from all the works that preceded me. I will put together Maimonides and Nachmanides and Rosh and Rif and Rambam and Rashba and Ritva and all the commentaries and I'll come down with a ruling. Now you don't have to listen to me, but the Jewish people accepted Shulchan Aruch's ruling. So that is Shulchan Aruch in a nutshell. An oversimplification, but with enough detail. Yes? So that's Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch lived about a little over 500 years ago. And he wrote the book Shulchan Aruch. The Jewish people accepted the Shulchan Aruch. Along came Rabbi Moshe Isserles, and he wrote footnotes. Again, an oversimplification. It's a bit of a broader story. But in a nutshell, he wrote footnotes. Most of the Ramah's footnotes are places where the Ashkenazi custom differs from the Sfardi custom. Rabbi Yosef Karo was Sfardi. Rav Moshe Isserles lived in Krakow in Poland, and he wrote the Ashkenazi custom. So most of the differences are in customs. They do have some halachic differences, but they are rare. They are few and far between. So far, so good? Okay. Now let's move forward. We have the Shulchan Aruch and his rulings, and the Jewish people primarily accepted that. For the next 500 years, from Shulchan Aruch onward, the rabbis gave themselves the title Achronim. They said, all the rabbis who preceded the Shulchan Aruch, they are called Rishonim, the first commentaries on Talmud. And ever since the Shulchan Aruch, the rabbis decided, we are not on the same level as the rabbis before the Shulchan Aruch. We can't argue on them. The rabbis decided. There were exceptions. Shagat Aryeh, the Gra, there are exceptions. But primarily the rabbis decided, we cannot argue on the rabbis of the earlier generations. And so they gave the title to all the rabbis who preceded the Shulchan Aruch, they called them Rishonim, the first commentaries. And they gave themselves the title Achronim, latter commentaries. And what happens is we have an expansion. The rabbis work on how should we rule? Do we go with the Shulchan Aruch on this? Don't we go? And what, how do we apply the Shulchan Aruch's ruling in this scenario or that scenario? So you have great discussion. Not all the rabbis agreed with Shulchan Aruch. Many of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch disagree with him. The Shach, the Taz, the Magen Avraham, commentaries on Shulchan Aruch sometimes argued with him. In the Ramah's own days, in his town, was a rabbi called Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Rashal. He wrote a book, Chochmat Shlomo, Yamshel Shlomo, and he argues on the Ramah. We have response back and forth, and he doesn't give in. Very vehement arguments against the Ramah. And throughout Shulchan Aruch, you see the footnotes, the commentaries point out, here the Rashal argues with him, and here the Rashal argues with him. And we don't always go with Shulchan Aruch. Usually we do. 95% of our halacha is with Shulchan Aruch. But now we understand the evolvement from Moshe to Talmud. Yes, Mishnah, Talmud. And now to Shulchan Aruch. Now, 100 years ago, there lived a rabbi named Rabbi Yisrael Meir of Radin, otherwise known as the Chafetz Chaim. And Rabbi Yisrael Meir went to the different rabbis of Europe and he said, there have been so many commentaries written on the Shulchan Aruch, we have to make a compendium, an encyclopedia of the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. And he asked many rabbis to do it, and they all refused. So finally he saw no one was going to do it, and he said, it has to be done. So he took his son and his son-in-law, and he said, we will write it. And they divided the work. It was a team effort. And together they wrote what we know today as the Mishnah Berurah. Wait, slowly. So what the Mishnah Berurah does is the Mishnah Berurah gathers the different commentaries that existed over the last 500 years since the Shulchan Aruch. Now, only on one volume of the Shulchan Aruch did they do it. Shulchan Aruch is divided into four volumes, right? Orachaim, the day-to-day. Yore De'ah, the laws a rabbi needs to give ruling on. Choshen Mishpat, the laws of monetary matters. And Evan Ezer, marital laws. Yes? Four volumes. So, Mishnah Berurah wrote on Orachaim. They divided each volume into three, because there's a lot of commentaries. But really, it's four volumes. So, Mishnah Berurah only wrote on volume one, on Orachaim. It's true, Mishnah Berurah exists six volumes, but it's two lines Shulchan Aruch, and the rest is all Mishnah Berurah. So that's what the Mishnah Berurah did with his son and son-in-law. They put together this encyclopedia called Mishnah Berurah, which puts together the different opinions that are relevant and gives us a bottom line. That's the Mishnah Berurah. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is just a work which took the Shulchan Aruch and the commentaries and gave you one opinion, Rabbi Ganzfried. He lived also about 100 years ago. And his opinion, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch simply takes, it's a short version that's good for the average person who doesn't know how to learn. It gives them a short bottom line. Here's what you do here, here's what you do, here's what you do. He gives them the laws that are relevant to him. So the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch also included, in his short lines, he included the different opinions, but he always gives you one opinion. He doesn't usually tell you more than one opinion. He usually says, this is what you do, and this is what you do. Now, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was Ashkenazi.
Sometimes it says that the Mishnah Berurah says something else than the Shulchan Aruch. My Shulchan
Aruch. That's the editors put in. That's not in the original version. Rabbi Ganzfried didn't write that. The Mishnah Berurah quotes the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Mishnah Berurah came after Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote Mishnah Berurah. Now, the same idea that the Mishnah Berurah did also did the Kaf HaChaim. In for the Sfaradim, he did a very encompassing work. And then you have two other works, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Rebbe of Chabad, the Baal HaTanya, wrote a work which also tries to do the Shulchan Aruch together with many of the later commentaries, and the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Epstein. They did works, whereas the Mishnah Berurah has a quote of the Shulchan Aruch and then footnotes combining all the different opinions. One second. The Baal HaTanya, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and the Aruch HaShulchan, they wrote their own text. They don't begin with the text of the... That's true of the Aruch HaShulchan and the Baal HaTanya. Give me a second. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav. I don't remember right now. I don't remember the format. I don't remember.
What?
I don't remember if the Shulchan Aruch begins with the Shulchan Aruch Rav begins with a quote from the Shulchan Aruch. I don't remember. I don't think so, but I'm not 100% sure. I have to check.
The Aruch
HaShulchan
begins with the first
verse
from the Shulchan Aruch.
No. Okay. Beseder?